Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
At some point in any economic story, it becomes more about the politics. We're there with the Europeans, and we're there in Washington. So, sovereign debt and the super committee today, although not together. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Welcome to the Marketplace Podcast for Friday, the 11th of November. Good to have you with us. So listen, let's do this. Let's forget for, the first 4 minutes of the show that there is a European debt crisis, all right? Because goodness knows we've all spent a whole lot of time on that lately, and we'll get there in due course today on the broadcast. But what I want to do first is talk domestic economic stuff. We're going to do that with John Carney from CNBC, Lizzie O'Leary from Bloomberg News as well, and a little bit of live radio we like to call our weekly wrap of Wall Street and beyond. Hey, guys.
Hi.
Hello.
All right. So, hello, John. You're very enthusiastic today.
I am. I'm rearing to go.
All right. Well, so here we go. Lizzie, I'm going to read you some wire copy. It crossed on the Associated Press a couple hours ago. Dateline, aboard Air Force One, it says, Obama spoke with members of Congressional Supercommittee on Friday to urge them to strike a deficit deal. So that's where we are. They have to be reminded, these guys, that they have to strike a deficit deal?
Well, look, this is the very fine line of the politics of this thing. You said this is all about politics. The White House wants some buy-in here or the impression of some buy-in, but not too much. Because remember, if it comes from the White House, then it might be sort of more odious for the congressional masses who are theoretically supposed to vote on this thing by December 23rd.
Yeah, November 23rd, right? Day before Thanksgiving.
Well, they got to get the agreement then. Yeah.
So, John, are they going to get a deal? I mean, you know, lay the odds for me. You're a gambling man.
I'd say there's about a 50-50 chance of a deal right now. You have to remember the super committee was really set up to save face for everyone for a few months. And, you know, I think the hope was, well, the economy might look a little better. So government revenues will go up, because of that. And, you know, then a couple people might shift. Maybe the Democrats will be open to a few more cuts and the Republicans might soften a bit. But that hasn't really happened. The economy hasn't dramatically improved so that we can expect much better revenues in the future. We haven't seen either side shift at all. So I don't think we're very close at all. So I wouldn't be surprised if we get some sort of face-saving measure to push it back out into the future, maybe closer to the 2012 election.
Oh, yeah, because that's what we need. So, Lizzie, let me ask you this, though. There's all kinds of talk, and it has been for a while now. We just haven't really concentrated on it, that what Congress is going to do, specifically with relation to all these defense cuts, is basically say, yeah, super committee, you said this, and trigger mechanism that, but we're not going to cut the Defense Department, and we'll just pass another law that lets defense have, you know, its cuts and eat it, too, if you will.
Well, I mean, that's certainly something that people on the Hill have been talking about. I would say be a little careful with that. I called up John Chambers from S&P, who's the head of their, sovereign debt. And I said, sovereign rating. So if they kind of exclude the defense part of this, if defense isn't subjected to cuts, what would happen? He said, if they weakened the law that governs this, if they weakened the Budget Control Act, that's the agreement that started this whole thing in the first place, that would put downward pressure on the U.S. debt rating.
So, I love that.
Right,
downward
I know.
Pressure.
We're here again. Yeah. So even some of those wiggle out of the way solutions could have market consequences.
Well, John, play that out a little bit. So let's say there is downward pressure on credit ratings. I mean, what do you do? What happens?
It's completely ridiculous. The Congress should ignore all talk coming from anybody at a rating
agency.
There's
the John Carney I know and love. Good job, man. How to play your part.
The last time they brought – remember, when we got downgraded the last time around, the interest rates actually fell on our debt. This is good for us. We have the strongest credit in the world. What are you going to do? Are you going to go to China, which is seeing its exports to Europe being wiped out? Are you going to go to Europe? They have their own problems.
Italy, they look great
right
now.
Yeah, let's go to Greece.
Right. You know. So, you know what? in this world today, I would not worry for a minute about what the credit rating agencies say. They only really downgrade themselves when they downgrade America. And what Congress should do is figure out what's the right thing to do for the economy and not worry about what some pointy-headed academic who works for S&P.
You need to come visit, John.
I know, right? You need to spend more time in Washington. All right, Carney, you have literally 5 seconds to answer this question. You're not really serious that Congress ought to think about what's best for the economy, because how are they doing so far?
They're very bad, but that's because every side is addicted to this idea that the U.S. right now, its budget deficit is a big problem. That is not our big problem. Borrowing money is not any worse than taxing the money. If you have problems with spending, you should take care of that, but not because you're worried about some abstract concept of the budget deficit.
All right, we got to go. John Carney from CNBC, Lizzie O'Leary from Bloomberg News. Good weekend, you guys.
You too.
Bye, Kai.
So on Wall Street today, no bond trading, lots of action in equities. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Okay, so any takers out there for little Italian sovereign debt? Anyone? What about Greek bonds? Anybody? Yeah, that's kind of what the markets are saying, too. Now that banks and other big investors are madly trying to get rid of the billions of dollars worth of government debt they hold, lest it turn out to be worthless, you could say sovereign debt's looking a little bit toxic. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith has the story.
Not so long ago, when you wanted a super safe place to put your money, government bonds topped the list. Marilyn Cohen is a bond manager for Envision Capital Management.
It used to be thought of as the creme de la creme, that a country can't default and their AAA status would never be impaired.
Cohen says banks and institutional investors believed this so strongly, they loaded up on European debt, even though some Eurozone economies were sputtering. Then these investors realized their Greek bonds were worth half of face value. Beth Ann Bovino is an economist with Standard & Poor's.
We just saw holders of Greece's debt being asked to accept a 50% haircut. What would happen if this happened to Italy? And investors, of course, are rightfully panicked.
As of June, American banks reportedly held $47 billion worth of Italian debt. European banks, more than $800 billion. Bovino says it's not so different from the days of mortgage-backed securities, a once-coveted investment becoming a hot potato. Market analyst Dan Nigro says investors are worried that the Eurozone can't guarantee the debt of its members.
I fear that everyone realizes that the euro resources are not capable of defending Italy, plus Spain, plus Portugal, plus Greece.
Which could mean banks are once again sitting on hundreds of billions of dollars of assets that may no longer be worth hundreds of billions of dollars. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
The crisis over Italy's prodigious debt load did ease a tad today. The Italian Senate passed a package of austerity measures and economic reforms. And once it gets by the other house of parliament, perhaps tomorrow, Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi is expected to resign as promised. And financial markets were cheered by the prospect today, as you'll hear in just a bit. But Italy has more than just debt to worry about. It's one of the slowest growing economies around. Marketplace's Stephen Beard has that story from Rome.
In her women's clothing store in central Rome, Cristina Giardaluca greets a customer and proudly shows off her wares. Every skirt, sweater, scarf and handbag here was made in Italy with Italian style and quality. The trouble is, Cristina says, the business of selling these products is coming apart at the seams.
Running a small business up to now is quite impossible.
Cristina is buckling under the burden of heavy taxes and regulation.
First, the human resources, how to get and pay a staff if you want to be in the law and pay everything the government wants you to pay.
For her one employee, she has to pay not only $16,000 a year to the worker, but a further $38,000 to the government. Just to break even, she must keep her shop open 10 hours a day, 7 days a week.
It's impossible to me to just to rest or to take a day off or whatever, you know.
It sounds like slavery.
Yeah, I think I'm the slave of the government at this point, yeah.
In a recent survey, Hong Kong came top as the easiest place for setting up and running a business. The US was fourth, Italy was 70th.
I think it's a real key to understand the difficulties of the Italian economy.
Author Stefano Cingolani says Italy depends heavily on its small businesses, but then strangles them with red tape and hammers them with heavy taxes. This helps explain Italy's low growth.
All these small entrepreneurs, now they are really suffering. They need more freedom to organize their business.
But the government's belated attempts to free up the economy and cut public spending have not been met with universal rejoicing. Rome erupted after an anti-austerity rally last month. Roberto Treu of Italy's most powerful union says the protests will go on.
We are afraid that economic reform will hurt public workers, pensioners and vulnerable peoples.
But you do accept that some reform is necessary?
Yes, it's necessary. We agree with this. But not penalise ordinary working people in the country.
In some ways, Italy is a microcosm of the Eurozone. It contains both ends of the spectrum. The north resembles Germany, the south looks more like Greece. And journalist Sherry Jennings says this disparity helps explain some of Italy's public debt.
You have the industrial north that's very productive, and then in the south, it is poorer. So in order to keep the country together, the government has been taking money from the north to subsidize the south for many years. And that's where a lot of this debt comes from.
In her clothing store in Rome, Christina Giardaluca says small businesses like hers bear the brunt of the Eurozone debt crisis. Business is bad. Her customers have money, but they're afraid to spend it.
Everybody's afraid because when you listen at the news in Italy, they do a sort of terrorism, you know, oh, it's going to happen this, oh, it's going to happen that, and because Berlusconi and this and that, and people are just frightened because they don't know where the country is going anymore.
Italy's expected to have a new government this weekend, but dispelling the fears about the country's future may take a little longer. In Rome, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
It feels, today anyway, as though Europe has taken a step back from the edge of the economic abyss. But on the theory that this story has looked like it's played itself out before, we thought it might be good to understand how we got here in the first place. And for that, we've called Steven Weber. He teaches political science at the University of California, Berkeley. Steven Weber, good to talk to you.
Delighted to be here.
I wonder if we can say that we have now come sort of full circle with the European Union. We are having economic problems play out politically, which gets us back to the beginning of this thing, which was economics and politics after the Second World War.
Well, I think that's right, Kai. The EU, first and foremost, is really a political project that's wrapped up in a kind of an economic brand. And particularly for people outside of Europe, we focus on the brand rather than the underlying political project. And we need to pay more attention to what that is.
Well, explain that a little bit, because the thing that's putting the fear of God into everybody is the economic facade, the brand.
Yeah, exactly. Well, if you go back to the early days, I mean, why was this thing created in the first place? It was a creature of the Second World War, fundamentally. The Germans and the French got together in what people thought at the time was a marriage of convenience, but really was deeper than that. It was a deep romance based on a conviction that after two world wars and the kind of trauma that these countries faced in the first half of the 20th century, they really had to bind their fates together fundamentally. And the best way to go about that ultimately was by binding economies together. And that's where it all started in the European coal and steel community.
Wow, the European coal and steel community, which begat the European economic community, right? And then that turned into the EU, if I have my dates right.
Exactly. So think about it. You know, if it's 1951 and you have two countries that want to find some way to commit to each other, that they're never going to go to war against each other again, what better way than to combine your coal and steel industries? I mean, you can't mine coal. You can't make your own steel. It's pretty hard to develop a modern army.
So let's skip a couple of decades then and get to the single currency, the euro, and where that plays into this whole thing, right? Because it seems to me we've got two topics. We have the European Union and then we have the eurozone.
The Cold War ends in 1989, and that looks like a great moment for Europe, except what it means is that what are we going to do about a reunified Germany? And so the Europeans typically, in a case like that, see a crisis, look for a solution. They kind of kick the can down the road for a year, 2 years, 3 years, and then eventually come up with the idea of economic and monetary union. And before you know it, you have a single currency called the euro.
And yet we also have over there a central bank that can't dictate terms to all, I guess it's now 17 or still 17 members. And there are structural problems that sort of get us to where we are today.
Well, as is often the case in all kinds of monetary unions, you know, you solve one problem, you create another. If you have a single currency, but you have essentially autonomous fiscal policies, you've got an imbalance in the system. But, you know, if the Americans, if we were all sort of fell into a period of complacency about our housing market during the last decade, the Europeans fell into a complacency about that imbalance with their independent fiscal policies. And people sort of forgot that it ultimately wasn't going to work.
Well, as we look back then, let's say 5 years from now, whenever we get to the other side of this crisis, what does the European Union look like then?
I think the one thing we can rule out, at least I believe we can rule out, is a breakup of the European Union. Mm. For this generation of European leaders, a conscious decision to break up the European Union would be perceived as the equivalent of a conscious decision to go to war. It wouldn't be that decision, but that's how it would feel to them. And so the question is, what will they pay to get to the other side? So I think 5 years from now, we may see a Europe that is meaningfully smaller in some respects, but more tightly coherent and better balanced.
Steven Weber, he's a professor of political science up at the University of California, Berkeley. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Coming up,
they're singing our song.
And it's not Kumbaya, let me tell you. Organize labor and occupy Wall Street. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial surged 259 points today, a little bit better than 2%. Wrapped things up at 12,153. The NASDAQ advanced 53 points, an even 2%. Finished at 2,678. The S&P 500 tacked on 24 points, just shy of 2%. Closed at 1,263. So where did this week's Wheel of Fortune come to rest, you ask? The Dow added 1.4% for the 5 days gone by. The S&P 500 up 0.8%. The NASDAQ slipped down 0.3% since Monday. All 30 blue chips traded in the green today. Walt Disney led the Dow higher. But thanks to a big jump in quarterly profit, shares of the entertainment conglomerate skyrocketed 6% higher. U.S. bond market was closed for Veterans Day, and you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Monday. It's a brainy event. The Society for Neuroscience continues its annual meeting in Washington. The World Health Organization marks World Diabetes Day. It estimates that more than 346 million people worldwide have the disease. And on November 14, 1972, the Dow Jones Industrial Average hit a milestone, topping 1,000 for the first time. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media is another way to say that. I'm Kai Rizdal. This is a big weekend if you like to watch people beat each other up. There's a championship boxing match. Welterweights Manny Pacquiao and Juan Manuel Marquez meet Saturday night. But boxing's not the be-all and end-all it used to be in ring-based physical combat. Mixed martial arts has been gaining audience share for a while now, and it debuts in a primetime network slot on Fox Saturday night. Marketplace's Eve Tro has the story.
Sure, boxers punch each other, but with veritable pillows on their wrists compared to mixed martial arts, where fighters can kick and wrestle and wear much thinner gloves.
Unloading with the vicious rights, one after another. Replay shows the punch that opened up a cut over Lieben's eye with the blood flowing immediately.
I think if you get past a few rounds, it seems like there will be blood. It really does.
Dan Rasher is a sports economist at the University of San Francisco. He says mixed martial arts was all about the blood in the 1990s, a raw fringe sport that Senator John McCain called human cockfighting. Now it's been consolidated into a professional league, the Ultimate Fighting Championship, or UFC. Rasher says his students, mostly guys in their 20s, pushed him to study the business model.
And that's when I realized, you know, that UFC is valued at over $1 billion, approaching $2 billion, which really, really turned my head.
In a new book called Tapped Out, fighter and author Matthew Polly says the sport grew by adding rules and weight classes. It's no longer just two guys going gonzo.
It's cleaned itself up.
real credit goes to the UFC for pushing this as hard as they have.
And the Fox Network will make Ultimate Fighting look like a first-class sport, with high-tech lighting, sound, and camera work it's never had. Polly says longtime fans may feel a bit sad.
It's like your indie band went mainstream.
The fan base is set to explode, he says, and mixed martial arts is poised to knock out boxing as the most popular sport in the ring. I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
This could turn out to be a decisive weekend for the various Occupy encampments across the country. Police and civilian officials from Burlington, Vermont, all the way to Oakland, California, and points in between are saying it's time for the protesters to move on. There have been shootings, a couple of deaths, and other violence that's just making them nervous. Organized labor is also unsure of where things stand. Unions started working with Occupy Wall Street a couple of months ago, and it's not an easy relationship, as Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer reports.
They're an odd pair. The no-one's-in-charge protester philosophy clashes with the hierarchy-happy unions, but so far they're making it work. You can see that here in Washington. The National Nurses United Union has set up a medic tent in McPherson Square near the White House, headquarters for Occupy D.C. Union nurses take turns staffing it. Megan Honor Kane is on duty right now, dealing with minor problems.
Like small cuts or scrapes or injuries. I'm just wanting to clean those up.
Cough drops. Protester Laura Potter hands out cough drops and aspirin from the union. She says the Service Employees International Union, or SEIU, has also pitched in with some key amenities, like toilets.
And they were desperately needed, let me tell you.
Protesters around the country have returned the favor. Just two nights ago, protesters in New York turned out for a Teamsters rally at Sotheby's, heckling well-heeled Sotheby's clients. The Teamsters represent art handlers in rocky contract talks. Protester Jackie DeSalvo helped organize the Sotheby's rally with the Teamsters. She's part of Occupy Wall Street's labor committee, set up specifically to coordinate with unions.
Well, they come to our rallies. We plan things, and we plan it with them in mind, and they join us when we have protest demonstrations.
The protesters' voices have reached Teamsters President Jimmy Hoffa's hushed office suite in Washington.
They're singing our song.
Hoffa says the demonstrators are steering the national conversation toward union themes with their simple "We are the 99% message. Now Hoffa is trying to shape what comes next. His strategy, broaden the message.
But let's talk about jobs. Let's talk about trade. Let's talk about food stamps. Let's talk about more specific issues where there's such, you know, dramatic inequality.
Mark Bayard heads Cornell's Labor Institute. He says big labor has to be careful. Labor doesn't want to be accused of taking over the Occupy movement and looking desperate while the protesters are somewhat aloof.
They, I don't think, need any institution as much as, you know, institutions like the labor movement need them, because they're sort of an organic burst of energy. Whether they're around 6 months from now or not, the issues that they're talking about will resonate for some time to come.
Bayard doesn't know if the Occupy Wall Street movement has enough horsepower to pull labor out of its decades-long slump and inspire broader public support. As it is, the unions may not even be able to motivate the young demonstrators to join up. 34-year-old Daryl Henderson has been camping with Occupy DC for about 2 weeks. He's never been in a union. I asked him, would he ever try to start one?
I think that's going to be a dilemma for me. It's going to vary according to where I'm working at and how it is.
Henderson says he might not need a union if he's getting good pay and benefits. Young people like Henderson have never seen a strong union movement. They grew up in a time of union decline. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on a Friday, the news that didn't quite make the front pages this week, courtesy of Rico Galliano, Brendan Francis Newnham, and the rest of the Marketplace staff.
John Haas, editor of Marketplace. What story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
The conventional wisdom would say that people who make less money go to fast food places more. But actually, a new study out shows that it's the higher income earners who tend to go to the fast food joints. People making as much as $80,000, $90,000 a year.
Is that because they work longer, so they need the convenience?
I think it's just because they have health insurance.
Rod Abid, senior producer of the Marketplace Morning Report. What story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
I'm going to be talking about the most exclusive Occupy Wall Street protest in the country. It is, guess where? Harvard University.
Really? What happened?
Well, before a big general assembly at Occupy Harvard, the campus cops closed the gates and wouldn't let any outsiders / riffraff into the protest.
So this isn't the students, this is the school.
The school is keeping it as exclusive as the school itself, yes.
You may be part of the 99%, but we don't want you to mingle with them.
Yes, and now it'll cost $60,000 a year to camp in their tent city.
Adrian Hill, reporter for Marketplace. What are you going to be talking about?
I'm going to be talking about all the really bizarre things that the date 11-11-11 is inspiring people to do.
Like?
Well, there are a ton of marriages going on all over the world today. People are buying lottery tickets with the numbers 1111.
That makes no sense to me, because if they win, that means they have to split it between all these people.
Exactly. And then I'm kind of embarrassed to admit I bought into one of these bizarre behaviors, which is corduroy day.
What does corduroy have to do with this?
Well, what number could possibly look more like corduroy than 11-11-11?
1970.
Thank you, Brendan.
All right, that was awesome, 1970, because 11-11-11, come on. The radio show Rico and Brendan do is called The Dinner Party. There's a link to the podcast on our website. It's marketplace.org. And that is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's acting producer is Megan Larson. The executive producer of the program is Deborah Clark. J.J. Yore is the vice president and general manager. Coming up this weekend, our personal finance show Marketplace Money teams up with the New York Times for a look at the state of home ownership.
Little did we know that within 24 months after we bought this place, that this whole artificial bubble would explode.
I'm Kai Risnell. We'll see you back here on Monday. Have yourself a great weekend. This is APM. That's American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.